For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast. Before we start our chat today, a trigger warning. We will be talking about suicidal ideation, in this case, in adolescents. In the mid-roll, we will be providing resources and contact numbers for help and support should this topic raise issues for you. On the 6th of June, the MJA published a pair of papers on suicidal ideation in adolescents and the role school-based prevention programs can play in supporting those teenagers. One paper was research by Grummet and colleagues reviewing the Preventure program. The other was an editorial by Associate Professor Fiona Shand and Dr. Michelle Torok from the Black Dog Institute.
There's been lots of research, including several systematic reviews now, which show that asking people, and young people in particular, about suicidal thoughts doesn't lead to any harm. And for young people, actually, there is likely benefit.
Fiona and Michelle are my special guests today. What do we know about the teen suicide rates in Australia at the moment? And we'll get to suicidal ideation in a minute, but let's just talk about that one for the moment.
What we know is that for young people, that suicide is the leading cause of death. It's not necessarily that the rates are higher than for other age groups. That's more because they're less likely to die from other causes, I suppose. But it is nevertheless a concern. And I think when we look at what's been happening in recent years, it's telling us that although the pandemic didn't cause an increase in suicide rates at this point, based on what we know so far, if we start to look at age groups, we know that it is young men, so that late teens, early adulthood group, where there actually is a bit of an increase in suicide deaths that have been emerging during the pandemic, I suppose. So overall, the rates look much better than we had expected.
Good.
But if we start to drill down into who was actually at risk, it does look like young men in particular who seem to be more at risk. And then if we do the same thing with self-harm rates in Australia, so what we have seen again in the last couple of years over the course of the pandemic is an increase in help seeking for self-harm, hospital-treated self-harm. And again, that is largely driven by people in that younger age group. So, you know, they are a group that I think have struggled more during the pandemic than perhaps others. So there is a real need to address that at a whole of population level, I think. We can't just rely on the health system to support young people because they may not get picked up, they may not have easy access. So the focus on schools and other environments to support young people.
I think that's a really good point, Fee, because there was a really nice study, and it'd be a few years old now, but it's basically called the iceberg model, and that showed how much more prevalent the issue of self-harm in particular is in the community than what we see in hospital presentation rates, which is a kind of at the moment kind of source of truth for like most of the estimations around self-harm. So I think in that paper, they did show that self-harm was about 10 times more prevalent in the community than what we see in the official kind of hospital presentation rates.
So let's talk about suicidal ideation. What do we know about what teens are thinking about in that story? Do we know, you know, what the proportion of teenagers are that are having suicidal thoughts?
Suicidal ideation is a bit harder to estimate. It's not routinely captured in administrative data sets. So when we estimate suicidal ideation, it's largely from large-scale surveys. It does look like it's more prevalent in young people. So while around kind of 13% of all Australians aged 16 and above would experience suicidal ideation in their lifetime, the rates are estimated more around between 20 and 40% in adolescents. And we did do some school-based research recently, which is largely consistent with that latter finding. So around 50% of the sample were experiencing some level of ideation, and around a third had quite severe ideation. It is not uncommon in adolescents.
Are teenagers accurate self-reporters?
I don't think that we've got any reason to think that they're less accurate than anyone else. And I think if they are assured of their confidentiality, and there are always some caveats around that, then they are reasonably accurate self-reporters. The problem is, of course, when we do school-based research in particular, if someone does indicate that they're having thoughts of suicide, we are required to flag that so that we can follow up with a person and make sure that they're safe. So, you know, it may be that there is some under-reporting going on. I doubt that there's over-reporting.
It's reasonably consistent across different countries, so that speaks to some consistency, yes.
When do we start developing coping mechanisms for emotional crises? What's the developmental line for that?
Look, I suppose it starts in very early childhood when children learn how to, with support from a caregiver, how to regulate their emotions, how to self-soothe, to know that they're safe in doing so. So the early childhood period is critical for that, and it kind of lays down the foundations often for what we see emerging in adolescence. You know, it is a lifelong process. I can put my hand on my heart and say I'm still developing my emotional coping skills. but I think adolescence is a particularly critical time for that. Even though those foundations are laid down early, you know, support for adolescents during that phase when they're starting to explore their identity, when they're starting to stretch their wings, to test their independence. And the fact that we know that, you know, around 14, 15 is when we see a very large proportion of mental illnesses emerge, that kind of tells us how important adolescence is for the development of those coping skills. So again, I think that speaks to the need for a focus on perhaps something broader than just suicide prevention, but for mental well-being for young people in schools. And I think argues for a universal approach to providing this support.
Can we draw a line from hurdles that kids have to overcome in young childhood through to whether or not they'll be self-harmers or if they'll attempt suicide? Is there the evidence base to be able to draw that line?
I would say yes, actually. You know, I think when we look at early childhood experiences and childhood adversity, that chronic childhood trauma is linked to a whole range of pretty awful outcomes for young people, not just suicide attempts, but substance use, some of the externalizing behaviors we see, as well as mental illness and a range of pretty horrible outcomes. So I think the evidence base is there in terms of trauma. That's not to say that all childhood adversity is bad. It does depend on the rest of the environment that they're in, the support that they're getting. And school engagement, I think, is both a good indicator of how the child is going, but also a good support and a good protective mechanism for young people, I think.
So is intervention or prevention, is it about figuring out which kids are likely to be vulnerable given their history, given their behaviours? Is it a matter of looking at a group of school kids, say, and saying, here are the ones we think might be at risk?
It's a bit of everything, I think, with suicide prevention, because you do have that group with those risk factors, but then you do have many kids you often hear that we didn't see anything going on with that kid, we wouldn't have known that kid was at risk. Suicide is, it's quite complex in that there are known risk factors, but there's no ones that are kind of more robust than others at this stage, and things can trigger, suicidal distress without any real forewarning. We know that mental health and suicidal distress are comorbid, but you can have suicidal distress without a history of mental illness, and similarly, you can have mental illness without ever experiencing any suicidal distress. I think there is a lot of worth in building up all children's coping skills and their resilience in case they encounter adversity. And we do know that adolescence is that period of a lot of change, and schools in particular are often where I think kids will experience, for some kids, that's where they'll first experience some of that adversity. So they might encounter bullying, or there's academic stresses, relationship breakdowns, all that stuff is happening in the school setting, and that's potentially where kids are experiencing that for the first time. If we can be using that as a setting to build up some of those protective skills, I think that's to everyone's benefit.
Whilst we said that trauma is clearly a risk factor, it isn't the only one. And so our understanding of who is actually at risk is not strong enough, and I'm not sure it ever will be, actually. I'd like to think that it would, but it may not be. But it's not really strong enough to be able to say with any certainty, this is the cohort of young people who are at risk. And, you know, for example, if we think about perfectionism, very high levels of perfectionism are also linked to suicidal thoughts and behaviours. Yeah. So it isn't just about trauma. So I think whilst that's a really useful angle, I agree with Michelle that universal approach to building up young people's coping strategies is probably the best one at this stage.
Are teenagers good at asking for help, at recognising that they need help?
Michelle, you've published a paper on this with Lauren recently. Did you want to comment on that?
They're not good at asking for help. for sure. So beyond our research, there is very good evidence that it's really only about a third of young people in adolescence who experience suicidal distress who will seek help from mental health services. So we know they're not good at seeking help, and that's for a range of reasons, stigma, embarrassment. There is, to some level, literacy, so not understanding the problem that they're understanding the extent of what they're experiencing. Within my team, we recently explored this a bit further, but we were looking at kids who are actually engaging in mental health treatment and whether they're disclosing their suicidal ideation. And we found that 40%, even though they were in treatment, weren't disclosing suicidal ideation. And that was quite interesting, given that's quite a good opportunity to be receiving help for suicidality. And that was mainly because they were fearful of the repercussions if they did disclose suicidal thoughts, and uncertainty around the confidentiality and how they'd be protected if they did disclose. But a third, I think, interesting factor that did sort of come out of that was just a general sense of that they thought that the suicidal thoughts would just go away by themselves. So it wasn't, in a way, worth seeking help for. Yeah, it was a bit surprising to hear that latter one. But yeah, I think they prioritize their mental health. So a lot of people in our survey had depression and or anxiety, and that thing that was impairing their life the most at that moment. So that's what they wanted to get the help for. And I think sometimes suicidal ideation can be seen as quite secondary to that.
So you two have written an editorial for the MJA, and you're talking about some research we've published by Grummet and colleagues about a post hoc analysis of an intervention called Preventure. Can you tell us a bit about Preventure, what it was trying to do and how it went about doing it?
So Preventure is a selective program which looks at, it does look at young people who are at risk. And, you know, it really, I think it emerged from the alcohol and other drugs field. And, you know, so I think that's primarily been the focus of that, as well as the other program that was run alongside of that, which was the Climate Schools program. It was an interesting study in that they were looking at a universally delivered program alongside of a selectively delivered program. And so it's a little hard to tease out, I suppose, the impacts of some of those things. But I think they did, as one of their secondary outcomes was to look at suicidal ideation. They found that at the three-year follow-up, there was actually a significant reduction for young people suicidal thinking as compared to the no prevention group. So, you know, it's really pleasing to see that, because these are not easy outcomes to shift, I don't think. So I think it's really promising to see that that selective approach to intervention can also be useful.
Are schools good places for this? I mean, obviously that's where the kids are most of the time. But are schools good environments for suicide prevention and education programs? Is it hard to do?
We've had experience with implementing a different suicide prevention program. And I would say it has to have the support of the education department in order for it to be implemented effectively, would be my first comment. And they're not easy to implement with fidelity. And our research suggests that implementing these programs with good fidelity is really important, because when you start to change the content of a program, then you start to change the outcomes of the program as well. So that's not an easy thing to do in a school environment. I would say, though, that they are important environments because they are where most young people are. I think we need to be thinking about those young people who aren't engaging at school and who probably are more at risk, and looking at what other settings could we be doing this work in outside of schools. But I think the short answer is yes, but it's not an easy thing to do. And Michelle, you might want to comment on the appetite of schools for this kind of program as well.
Yeah, so I would agree that, yeah, schools are a great place for prevention, not only because of those kind of access and reach that Fiona's already spoken to, but I think going back to my earlier point, that schools are also that setting where a lot of issues onset that can feed into suicidal distress. So there is a relevancy aspect to this, that if we do prevention at various time points throughout schools, you're probably hitting some of those time points when people are experiencing the experiences that are leading to their suicidal distress. And I think universal prevention, which is where a lot of the school-based work is happening at the moment, is also quite good in terms of, it does, if it's for everybody, so universal prevention just means that everybody receives the intervention or the health promotion. And that reduces, I think, some of the stigma around receiving help in a way, because everyone is not singling out anybody. And I think it will work more or less effectively if you are experiencing issues at that time, though.
Yeah.
Schools, I think there is a big appetite for schools. So mental health is big at the kind of on the agenda for schools at the moment, particularly mm-hmm. post-COVID and all of the environmental threats that we've had in Australia recently. I think there's a challenges around this, which we might get to in a moment,
yeah,
but
for sure.
Schools want to do prevention. Suicide prevention is, I guess, a little bit more tricky. I think people get a bit worried when you start talking about suicide. So schools might meet a bit of resistance, I think, in the school community side of things.
Do teachers have an appetite for this?
I think they do. They do. And I think that's because they're at the, I guess, the kind of coalface of this, and there's benefit in supporting students' mental health, because we know that mental health is tied into it, sort of educational outcomes and that kind of social belongingness in school. And mm-hmm. and if you can improve mental health and well-being, then it will have flow-on effects for all of those outcomes. But there are obviously a lot of pressures on teachers. It's not easy to do prevention. It's not easy to do prevention, but when there are good programs that are a good fit for school, you do tend to see a lot of buy-in.
I'm chatting with Associate Professor Fiona Shand and Dr. Michelle Torok from the Black Dog Institute. The full links to their editorial and to the Grummet and colleagues' research can be found in the show notes to this podcast. If this podcast is raising issues for you, there is help available. For doctors and medical students in distress, contact the Doctors for Doctors service at 1300 374 377. You can also Google the Medical Benevolence Society in your state. The AMA peer support line can be called at 1300 853 338 or 1800 991 997. Hand-in-Hand Peer Support Service can be found at www.handinhand.org.au. And of course, Lifeline is always there at 13 11 14, as is the Suicide Callback Service on 1300 659 467, and Beyond Blue's support line at 1300 224 636. Back to our chat. Do the programs need to be tailored to each school?
Yes, they do. Ideally, do want to see some tailoring, because schools are inherently different. There's so many different types of schools, and what works for one school won't work for another school. We do want to, I guess, keep a focus on evidence-based programs. So ideally, you want to prioritise the delivery of evidence-based programs. And as Fiona mentioned before, it's with those programs that fidelity really matters. So they've been tested with a particular model, mm-hmm. and that's the model that works. So you want to retain that delivery model as much as possible. But where we, I guess, would like to see tailoring is in having a suite of evidence-based programs available where schools could choose ones that are a better fit for their school. Then there's also, I guess, when you're delivering something in a school, particularly a universal program at scale where it might be all the years of students who are receiving this, then you want to have some tailoring of the strategies that might support implementation. So whether you sort of have school champions to support this, or peer champions at the student level who are supporting it, or how the school executive buys into that program and engages the staff in the delivery, those are the things that can be more tailored to schools.
The other area where there can be tailoring is in the support strategies that sit around a program like this. So, for example, you know, it may be that teachers want to be upskilled in mm-hmm. how they identify and support young people. It may be that that's the same for school counsellors and school psychologists. It may be that the school will need to have a really clear referral pathway for when they feel like they can no longer support a student adequately and they need to call for more help. So I think the tailoring sits around the program as much as it sits within it.
So what is Youth Aware of Mental Health?
A program that emerged from a very large trial, actually, the SAIL trial in Europe. And I think it was around 11,000 students, Michelle, if I'm right. And they tested a number of strategies. They tested the Youth Aware of Mental Health program, they tested a gatekeeper training program. So that's kind of training, upskilling teachers and others in the school. They tested a screening program, universal screening of students, and there was a no control condition as well. And of the three active interventions, so that was YAM, gatekeeper training and screening, it was only YAM that really showed benefit for students in terms of improvements to mental health, improvements to help seeking, improvements in the extent to which they felt connected and supported, and importantly, improvements in suicidal thinking and behaviour. So it's a program that's developed, delivered by external facilitators. It's not actually a teacher-delivered program. It's a fairly interactive program, so there are a number of sessions, and they really engage the students in conversations around their coping skills, their help seeking, their mental health, etc. So we brought that to Australia as part of a larger suicide prevention project called Lifespan, and we have rolled it out in four regions of New South Wales to pretty much every public school and a whole bunch of private schools within those four regions. So aimed at year nine students, so, you know, 14 years-ish. And we measured it baseline at 3 months and 6 months, some of those outcomes, and found similar kinds of outcomes to what they saw in Europe. So it was really important for us to understand whether this program that was developed and tested in Europe could also work in the Australian context.
And you believe it is working?
Yeah. Michelle, did you want to comment on the outcomes?
It did, as Fiona has said, it did have some good outcomes. We did have, I think I spoke to earlier, quite high levels of suicidal ideation reported at that baseline survey for the YAM evaluation. And that, I think, halved. So the proportion of students experiencing suicidal ideation, I think, roughly halved by the at post-intervention. So that was quite in alignment with that big European trial that Fiona was just speaking to, which was quite promising. But we haven't been able to run it in a similar randomised controlled trial just because of pragmatic constraints, because it was part of a bigger suicide prevention trial, but very promising. And as a result, it has been quite widely adopted across New South Wales, which is really nice to see.
Most of our, well, a lot of our listeners are GPs. What role do GPs play in youth suicide prevention? And is there a way of working them in with any school-based prevention program? Is there a role there for GPs in terms of stopping this at the source, so to speak?
In the school setting, it probably is by and large schools knowing where to go to for help when they feel they can't support a student anymore. And I think, as Michelle said, it's really important, I think, that young people can develop that trusting relationship with their GP because they are concerned about disclosing suicidal thoughts for fear that they, you know, that it's going to, you know, I think as a young person, with not a whole lot of experience of this stuff, that there are really big fears around what it means I'm going to be automatically admitted to hospital, they're going to call the ambulance on me, those sorts of things.
Yeah.
So it is around, you know, having those gentle conversations with young people about confidentiality, being clear around what the limits of that are.
Yes.
And I think for GPs, not being scared of asking the question. So I think part of the fear is around, well, does it make the person unsafe? And the answer to that is clearly no. There's been lots of research, including several systematic reviews now, which show that asking people, and young people in particular, about suicidal thoughts doesn't lead to any harm. And for young people, actually, there is likely benefit. But there is also that fear around, well, what am I stepping into here? Do I have the skills to manage this? Do I have the referral pathways in place to manage this? Am I opening up a whole Pandora's box of things that I'm really not sure how I'm going to manage?
Yeah.
And so I think for GPs, many of them are already quite skillful in managing mental health issues, and it's important for them to understand that this is just an extension of that. So it's not something to be fearful of. Practices need to support GPs in having those referral pathways in place as well.
Should GPs be talking to the schools?
Anyone involved in supporting a young person through mental health issues, it's always good to ask that question. And, you know, again, I think making sure that the young person understands the limits of confidentiality, but having that conversation about, you know, would you be willing for me to speak to the school about this, this and this, so we can see if we can get more support for you at school. Whether that's a GP's role or a psychologist's role is a little unclear in my head at the moment, but I think there is benefit in creating some of those links with the young person's permission, obviously, the same as there is in, you know, engaging the family where that's helpful to do so. So, but it's always around having that conversation with the young person about letting them know, having that conversation about whether they're comfortable with that or not.
So, Michelle, wave a magic wand for me. If you had all the money and time in the world, how would you help kids with suicidal ideation?
Ideally, I would work in the school setting. So I think there's a lot of work to be done in the suicide prevention space. While it won't capture everybody, it will capture a good deal of young people. So what I would love to see is that we have basically multi-level prevention approaches available to schools, so that we have those kind of universal programs where you are, I think these really need to start in primary school, to be honest. We really are seeing these kinds of suicidal distress experiences emerging in the later primary school years now. So ideally you would have a program that kind of started in late primary school but extended through to high school. You would have universal prevention delivered quite ongoing basis rather than a just sort of one-off touch point during their school life. On top of that, you would have some kind of screening process in place to capture kids as they are becoming at risk, and you would have those more selective or indicated options for those higher risk kids. So whether that is through digital, sort of integrating digital interventions as they emerge into the school setting, building up those kind of school counsellor workforces, also bringing in the parents. So I think that bigger school community vision. So it's not just on the schools and in the schools. We really do need to make sure that we're bringing the parents into the conversation. They're being upskilled to know how to have conversations with their kids, what the potential support options are. I think just back to that GP conversation, I mean, I think we know that the GPs are a good touch point or first point of contact if you really are concerned, but I don't think that's commonly understood. Yeah. So it's just getting all that kind of useful information out into the whole school community so that it's really about that kind of safety, building that safety net rather than being any one person's responsibility to identify and intervene. But I really think a shift into prevention rather than treatment for young people, where we are doing a really good job of introducing them simple skills and cognitive kind of strategies, just to keep building those strategies to cope with stress and distress as they age up, would be amazing.
It's interesting that we've had this conversation without using the word resilience. Is resilience a swear word these days?
It can be a little. You know, I think what started out as a really well-intentioned concept is now being perceived as putting the responsibility onto the individual to be resilient under all circumstances, regardless of what the environment is, what's occurring in the environment and some of the stresses that might be put on them. So yeah. I don't think that was the original intention of it, but that is kind of how it's being understood.
So Fiona, what about your magic wand? What would you wish for?
Michelle's answer was brilliant. You know, I think what you've described is a really comprehensive approach. I guess the couple of things that I might add would be understanding that in order for schools to be able to support young people, that schools need to be properly resourced and funded and teachers need to be supported. I suppose the other thing that I would add is something I mentioned before, and that is, firstly, strategies to make sure that young people are engaged at school so that we can increase school retention, because we know that's good for a whole bunch of outcomes, including having a captive audience for universal prevention programs, but a whole lot more than that. But also recognising that there are potentially other settings for those young people who are no longer at school. And so I think the TAFE sector is important as well. And I would also add that, you know, it's those transition points that are often really challenging for young people. So the transition from school to university, for example, from university into, say, you know, particularly for medical students, that transition out of university into that first year is incredibly challenging and stressful. So understanding that those are risk points and that doing some prevention before that and during that is a really useful thing to do. So I think looking outside of the typical settings where we focus and focusing on those transition points would be the things that I would add.
Thank you. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.